The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the easiest way to create a beautiful website, blog, or online store for you and your ideas. Squarespace features an elegant interface, beautiful templates, and incredible 24/7 customer support. Try Squarespace at squarespace.com and enter offer code PEL at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace, build it beautiful.
This episode of The Partially Examined Life is also brought to you by edX, an online learning destination where you can take fascinating free courses from the world's best universities. Go to edX.org/PEL to start learning for free today. That's edX.org/PEL.
You're listening to The Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who were at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 121 is something like, what's the psychology behind behaviors typically referred to as sin? And we read St. Augustine's Confessions from around the year 400 AD, books 1 through 9. You can join the discussion, find a link to the text, and lots more information at partiallyexaminedlife.com. This is Mark Lintzenmeyer, facing toward my God at Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Seth Paskin in Austin, Texas.
This is Wes Allen in Boston, Massachusetts.
This is Dylan Casey in Middleton, Wisconsin.
Mark, man, that could not be more...
creepy.
That voice could not have been more dripping with something. I don't know.
It's the mood that Mr. Augustine put me in.
I could see the candles around you, Mark.
Mr. Aurelius Augustinus. That's his real name. Aurelius Augustinus. I just found that out this evening, reading the introduction to my text by, so Wes, you'd recommended this F.J. Sheed translation,
yep,
which is from 1940. It's not a very new translation. The version that they sell of it now, introduction by Peter Brown, edited with notes by Michael P. Foley. Those are a lot of good notes. It gives footnotes for every time he uses a Bible passage, which is the fucking time.
Yeah, but I didn't find that very useful.
I ended up buying this version that's clearly like bound as a public domain. It's a nice bound copy, but it's just literally the book from Sheed, I'm sure by some Christian press, Eterna Press. But the book is pretty good quality. It has a really great table of contents.
That's actually one of the things I liked about the Sheed.
The table of contents?
Is a little, the cheat sheet.
Yeah.
Tables of contents at the beginning of each book.
Yeah, back in the day, table of contents were really informative. So...
But it doesn't have page numbers on it. Each chapter, each book, I should say, says here's what happens in each of the chapters, but doesn't give you any page numbers. You just
mine has its page numbers for each subsection.
Okay.
I have a translation by somebody named Boulding, Maria Boulding.
Is it new or?
Yeah, I'm trying to find the date.
It's a lady, so it can't be that old.
1997. I looked it up and my local library had a couple of different translations. They had the one that Wes recommended and then they had a couple of others. And I looked this one up on Amazon. They had this one and it got really good recommendations for readability.
I found the Sheed pretty readable.
Yeah, me too.
But Augustine himself, not always incredibly readable.
In my wretchedness, I loved to be made sad and sought for things to be sad about. In my wretchedness.
Yeah, there's only so much of that I can take before I just want to shoot myself, basically. I have to take a break from the book.
Well, there's a kind of rhetoric about this process of not just the many prayers that he has, but also the kind of constant invocations. And it's familiar when I've been to fundamentalist services or something like that. They are just like this.
You've been to a lot of those?
I haven't been to a lot, but I've been to a couple.
Have you been searching?
No.
After your Manichaean phase, you...
No. No. But my son got invited to a summer camp last year at a local evangelical church by a couple of his friends. So he went.
There's got to be a girl involved in that.
There was not a girl involved. Huh. And so he went, and guess what I did? I volunteered to be a night chaperone for three of the nights. And so I would go there at like 10 o'clock at night and make sure everybody got to bed and all that stuff.
So you wouldn't get up to any hair picking.
Did you have to prevent them from praying too passionately together?
They were all separated by gender. And everybody was very, very nice. But there's definitely this rhetoric, you know, way of talking about your relationship with God and a way of displaying your dedication into the cause. And there's just words that you say and phrases that you have, all of which remind me of Augustine.
It's the self-hating thing. We should say for listeners, by the way, who aren't familiar, so he's telling his life story as a prayer to God.
A confession.
Yes. He's giving confession to God himself. There's a lot of life history, but a lot of it is just, it's told for the purpose of telling a story of his coming to God. That's the basic arc of these first nine books. But what you were getting at, Dylan, was this. Well, I don't know if I'm giving the right characterization of this, but what I felt as his sort of abject masochism, which I think is an important question because it goes to this whole question of sin. So, for instance, he's frequently going to talk about the wretchedness of lust and
yes,
the wretchedness of a worldly life, but he doesn't really sell that. His life doesn't look that wretched before. He's got a woman, and from what I could tell, he had multiple women.
He's fucking around the whole time, right?
Yeah. Augustine got laid.
Got laid many, many times.
Well, he had a common law wife, and then he had another common law wife later, but apparently he was actually faithful to his first common law wife, which was unusual. Like, it was not unusual to get hooked up with one of these common law wives, not somebody that you were going to marry because they weren't at your political station. So ultimately, he ended up jilting her because of his ambition and was set up for a marriage that he didn't end up going through with.
Right. But he took a mistress during the 2 years he was waiting for her to come of age, you know, to reach 12 years old. But there was a hint in there that he actually had more partners than that before and after. So, yeah, apparently he was faithful to his common law wife, but I saw suggestions in there, but that before and after that, he had gotten around.
Maybe we should be good doobies and sort of really introduce the whole thing the way Mark would have us do usually.
All right. So he writes this when he's in his 40s, like 43 to 46 years old, I believe, says my intro. And it covers pretty much birth through when he's 30. He was raised in an area, a very religious area of North Africa. There wasn't really any temptation toward paganism. However, the education was all read Latin, read the famous texts in Latin, recite large portions of it. So one of the things he objects to early on, for instance, is just having to say these things about the Roman gods as part of the stories. But really, nobody in his environment was a believer in that kind of thing. However, there were many versions of Christianity and Manichaeanism that was mentioned, the belief that good and evil are fundamentally different substances, like that they're the two powers at war and not that everything comes from God. It's a way of dealing with the problem of evil. So it's a story of his own conversion, but it's really a story of, in many ways, his intellectual development. So it ends up being about a lot of the ideas in question about the God's relation to the physical world, and the remaining books, 10 through 13, that we're not going to talk about today, but we are going to talk about next time, actually just take on that metaphysical stuff straightforwardly. So we're not really going to talk so much about that today. However, when he's analyzing his own past life, we do get a lot of theorizing about the psychology of sin, of why did it take him so long, even though he was raised Christian of some sort, but yet it took him a long time to sort of fully come around. So this conversion is not from atheism or something to Christianity, it's from just like not so declared to completely dedicating his life to Christ.
Well, to becoming a Catholic.
But not, he wasn't a Christian. I mean, his mother was a Christian and his father wasn't. He had lots of doubts about Christianity and, you know, a lot of his time and his interest in rhetoric, he's actually interested in arguments against Christianity, which is a lot of what Manichaeanism and some of the other things he was involved with entail. So questions, for instance, about the origin of evil and things like that. So, for instance, how there can be evil in the world if God is all good and omniscient and knows everything that's going to happen. Those sorts of questions. And the Manichaeans really do have an alternative answer. I think that Manichaeans also denied the divinity of Christ, although it's not like they denied him as a figure.
Yeah, and Manichaeans aren't Christians. I guess Wes just said that.
Now I'm doubting myself.
I think it might be kind of complicated, but we didn't read about Manichaeanism other than what he says about it.
It has an origin in Persia. It's a mishmash. It's the new agey kind of thing of the day.
Well, and a lot of the criticisms of Christianity are things like, just don't some parts of the Bible sound like either they don't make any sense, like the creation stories, or that they're morally objectionable, like the Old Testament fire and brimstone stuff. But some of the same questions that people raise about the Bible today. Well, he doesn't really sell us too hard on it more, but eventually I figured out the right answer. Or eventually he was taught the appropriate doctrine that made him satisfied enough, that left him feeling intellectually fulfilled. He's a strong believer in the search for truth. I don't know if the word reason actually pops up here. It's not like Aquinas, where the word reason becomes really central, I think. But it's definitely being intellectually aware and open to things. That's an important part of it. But he thinks fundamentally human infirmity is too great, right? Human weakness, the weakness of our reasoning faculties is too great. We don't have the light within ourselves. We need the light of God to show us. So it's like an intellectually curious, good-spirited person, there are certain conclusions that they're going to come to that Augustine is going to agree with. But a lot of it, I want to say you can't get without faith, but I don't even think he says it that way. He's sort of, you can't, unless God comes to you and fills you.
Well, it's grace, but he doesn't.
Yes.
He doesn't really explicitly.
He doesn't use that word.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But in other words, it's grace. Yeah.
Right. Unless you're on the God path, then you're going to be deceived by all sorts of things. Then your sensibilities are not going to be. And by the right path, it's not even just wanting to be a Christian. It ends up being something very specific and going with these correct answers to all the problem of evil and all that other stuff.
Well, and I think you're right, Mark, to point. The problem of evil dominates the intellectual development laid out in the first 9 books before his conversion, where that's sort of the main running theme as he's describing his education and what draws him and what he's convinced of. And then also along the way, there's sort of the color commentary from after his conversion about what was wrong with him, what his state was there as he's going along telling his story. And the problem of evil and how evil exists in the world and its relationship with God just looms large through the whole thing. And it makes sense, given that that would be the great separation between him and the Manichaeans, when he figures out how to account for evil in the world and God somehow being related to it and not being opposed to God. Then the next big thing is the relationship of sin and where sin comes from. If we are created by God, how is it that we can sin? Then the third part of it, I guess, is will, which brings us back to Eva's book.
Will is his way out. Will is his solution to the problem of evil.
Yes, exactly.
So my question is the question of substance, his struggle with seeing God as a substance, a bodily substance, tied up with his struggle with trying to understand the problem of evil?
I think it is tied up with it.
I think so, too. I'm wondering if it's worth our time to untangle it or not. I'm not sure it is.
Well, maybe it's worth saying what his solution is. He mentions what the solution is, even without getting into the detailed metaphysics that he gets into in book 10 and after.
It's a spiritual substance. That's the solution.
Yes.
Yeah. And he's helped out by the Neoplatonists there. So it's Platonic philosophy that helps him figure that out. It's unclear why he talks about how he couldn't imagine God except as a spatial being, which is kind of weird, right? At least to us.
Is it? Why do you say that's?
Because I think we're so used to the idea of a spiritual, non-spatial God, and maybe that's because Augustine is now part of the tradition. I don't know.
It doesn't sound so weird to ask where God is, right? And if you have a where that he is, it seems like pretty quickly it wouldn't be so crazy for it to be spatial. I mean, Augustine's solution does seem to loom large here, where you just sidestep the whole problem by saying that God is a completely different substance than what makes up the rest of the universe.
So, Wes, it does sound strange to me that he was struggling with it, but I think there's times where he encapsulates the problem as saying he's thinking in terms of God infusing everything, God right. being a substance that infuses everything. He says, so if you take like a bigger piece of stone, is there more God in a bigger piece of stone than in a smaller piece of stone? And he says, no, that's ridiculous. Of course, you can't think of amounts of God. So I think when he says that he struggles with the idea of thinking of God as a bodily substance, he's trying to wrap his mind around how God could be in everything and be complete in everything without respect to its extension, so to speak. You know, he talks about trying to conceive of the universe and its limits, and he still understood it as something finite, but trying to think of God as being outside of it. So his struggles don't sound so quite archaic. I do kind of get what he was struggling with, but you would suspect that there would be some alternative, like he was that he would be presented with an alternative theory by some Catholic that had a better solution, unless he's the one who's kind of inventing it through this whole process, which I don't know enough about to say.
So let me just give a flavor of his problem regarding God. This is in book 3, section 7, and then subsection 12. Do all translations have these subsections?
They're not subsections. They run through the whole chapter. But yeah, they're standard.
So towards the middle of 12, so I did not even know that God is a spirit, having no parts extended in length and breadth, to whose being bulk does not belong. For bulk is less in its part than its whole, and if it be infinite, it is less in the part circumscribed by a certain space than in its infinity, and so could not be wholly itself in every place, as spirit is, as God is. So that's the setup to that. I don't know, are there other places where he's musing about that? I know he sort of solves it at the end of the, yeah.
Just right at the beginning of the book, and this is what kind of made me like him a little bit, that even though the whole thing is just so drenched in prayer that it's hard to, you know, you kind of want to fast forward over the preface to every chapter where he has to suck up to God for a couple paragraphs before he says anything real. But right here at the beginning, book one, part one is just a paragraph or two paragraphs, and you sort of invoke God, God, come to me, you know. But number two is, but how can I call unto my God and Lord? For in calling unto him, I'm calling him to me. And what room is there in me for my God, the God that made heaven and earth? Is there anything in me, O God, that can contain you? All heaven and earth cannot contain you, for you made them, and in me them. Yet since nothing that could exist without you, you must in some way be in all that there is, etc. You know, it's almost like a greeting, the beginning. O God, let's talk. But how could I talk to you when you're not here? How is that working? Why am I saying, come to me? Where were you hiding? How could you have been over there and now you're coming over here? He sort of is self-reflective enough that since he's giving this monologue, that every sentence he says, he realized that there's something, there's a question in it. There's a puzzle in it. And that's what makes the whole book philosophically interesting.
Yeah. And he demands, that's where sort of the reason, or what we would think of the reasonableness, fits in. Well, I guess we should eventually talk about where the faith fits in and believing in God and submitting yourself to God and what that would imply regarding things that disagreed with what was sort of in plain sight to you. But in this, what Mark just read and in other sections, he has a kind of demand of what seems plainly to be the case to him, and demands of consistency on, like, the Manichaeans, that there's this section where he and others get very disgruntled with the Manichaeans because they simply do not have an answer to a particular philosophical problem. And in fact, when the account is made by one of their teachers, they see him as even walked into a trap and completely undermined anything that the Manichaeans would be saying because this teacher displayed such flawed logic with respect to it. He is thoughtful in an interesting way. I mean, I guess it's sort of his being theological, and his being theological is to ask questions that seem perfectly sensible, both of what has been said to him about the nature of God and how that can possibly be true. That is, he basically takes it as true based on scripture that God is everywhere. And then he's asking reasonable questions about, well, how can I be talking to you? How can I have you in me if you're everywhere? Stuff like that.
Right, which is all in line with this hermeneutics that we mentioned him in our hermeneutics thing, like that he was the first one to really systematically do that. And one of the reasons he was able to overcome these objections to, isn't the stuff in Genesis sound kind of ridiculous?
Yeah.
Is by reading it allegorically, that this was like a big thing introduced for him to.
It's not literal, and he's adamant about it, that it has to be interpreted.
You mentioned how this relates to reason again, and how it seems like, you know, of course, he's in asking these questions, he's making use of his powers of reason. But at least the way that this Peter Brown introduction to my volume spun this was that part of confessing is not just I did these sinful things before, but I am such a weak and faulty creature that these things puzzle me. So confessing an intellectual problem is actually part of the confession of how imperfect our reason is. Saying, I can't really understand. I know, you know, it certainly makes sense to say, God, come to me, But then when I think about the words, it actually doesn't make any sense because God can't come to me because he doesn't move. And so isn't that reflect upon my own, the weakness of my intellect is really what that means. The fact that he's asking these puzzles.
So prayer is integral to reflection because we rely on God. This isn't really part of the reading, but Augustine's version of the a priori is divine illumination. We rely heavily on God when we are reasoning. We can't do without his illumination.
Right. If we're sort of working on the wrong template of what God is, if we're using Manichaean beliefs, then we're fucked. You can't reason properly on his model.
Relatedly, so the question for me is, what's inspiring all this searching? It's not simply intellectual curiosity. It's pain. It's suffering, which he talks about a lot, despite
his mom getting
laid a lot. So he's looking for a way out of pain and suffering, and he, in a way, he's looking for a foundation and also a way of dealing with loss. So there's a lot of talk about the fact that I was kind of trying to figure out why he's so down on worldly things. That's one of the things that interested me about this book. Why sex is so bad and lust is so bad and all of those things. It's not like, for instance, Christians are prohibited from having wives, although, you know, the way the arc of this whole story is that he's on this quest to basically get rid of women. And it's not clear to me that the Christianity of this time, that it's inherently anti-lust, at least for the average person. So, and I think part of the answer comes to be, it's about finding a foundation that's not what he calls corruptible, but we could also say changeable. It's not something that changes in time or something that you can lose. So, and so it doesn't even have to be sex. It could just be, you might think the foundation of a good life is friendship, but you can see he sort of argues against that. He has friends who die. He laments at one point, treating this friend who died as if he were going to live forever. In a way, God is the sort of final, incorruptible, permanent foundation for things. It's a way of having something that you can't lose. And that's the sort of quest I see him on in this. This is intimately related to the way in which will can, he uses the word, this word, swerve away from God. Because part of the, he thinks the, this being caught up in the world of appearances and pleasure, it's a way of treating non-permanent things as if they were permanent. It's sort of a self-deception. And it also is intimately tied to pride and to thinking of yourself as a god. And so that gets us to this pear-stealing incident.
Yeah, that's a good place to go.
Okay, but before we go there, let's talk about our sponsors.
Squarespace.
Now, we had a lot of trouble making our website.
We still have a lot of trouble with our website.
And were we to have gone with this alternate solution with Squarespace, it would have been much easier.
Yeah, definitely. You know, building a website can be tough, even if you know your way around coding. Creating something that looks good and works well is a time-consuming affair. Lucky for us, Squarespace makes it easy to build beautiful websites without breaking a sweat. Squarespace provides simple, powerful, and beautiful websites that look professionally designed regardless of your skill level with no coding required. Not only does Squarespace provide you with intuitive and easy-to-use tools to create your website with, Squarespace also has state-of-the-art technology powering your site to ensure security and stability. And you know you can trust in Squarespace for your website needs when millions of people, myself included, and some of the most respected brands in the world trust in them too.
So you yourself as an individual are a customer?
I am a customer. I have not officially launched my website, but I am a customer.
Ah.
$8 a month gets you a beautiful, easy-to-build website, 24/7 online support. And if you're willing to subscribe for a year, you can even get a free domain. Start a trial with no credit card required and start building today. And when you do that, make sure to use the offer code PEL and get 10% off your first purchase to show your support for the Partially Examined Life.
Augustine should have done this, just has confessions on the web.
Well, I think the challenge for Augustine would have been if he had used Squarespace to build his website prior to his conversion, he might very well have used his website to document his lustful, licentious behaviors, which would have then been permanently on the interwebs after being documented by Google and the NSA. So it's probably a good thing for him that he was able to just gloss all of his past behavior in his own self-written autobiography. We thank Squarespace for their support. Squarespace, build it beautiful.
I want to talk about our friends at edX. They are revolutionizing the education world. Up to now, quality education or even higher education seemed out of reach to many. Now there is edX, an online learning destination where you can take fascinating free courses from the world's best universities such as Harvard and MIT. If you want to learn new skills, To advance your career and get the in-demand jobs, then edX is the answer. They have courses on a variety of subjects from computer science to management, IT services, engineering languages, and more for free. Some of these universities include Harvard, MIT, Berkeley, Caltech, and many others. Now, edX has over 500 courses from more than 80 universities and institutions. Representing every country in the world, edX has more than 4 million students right now. You have the option to purchase and receive a certificate of achievement signed by the instructor with the institution logo to verify your achievement and increase your job prospects. Founded by Harvard and MIT in 2012 and released as open source in 2013, edX's mission is to increase access to high-quality education for all, very similar to the mission of this very podcast. I went out to the edX site and took a look around and went directly to the philosophy section, as you might expect. And there I found Michael Sandel's Justice class and highly recommend you take a look. But also saw a class about philosophy and the First World War that's being taught by the University of Louvain over in Brussels. And that's a great university that I had some contact with back in my graduate days. And so I bet that's going to be a great course, and I recommend you take a look at that too. edX is offering these and the hundreds of other courses that they have available absolutely free. Go to edx.org/PEL to start learning for free today. That's edx.org/PEL.
All right, let's get back to it.
So in book one, he starts out as his criminal career as a baby, shitting everywhere and crying and otherwise being an asshole. And then he's escalated in book two to theft. But I thought part of the point of that pear stealing incident is that, you know, so his question is, and we discussed this a little bit with Eva, the Willing episode, but his question is, what is it that attracted to him? What did he get out of stealing those pears? Because it wasn't for the pleasure of eating them or anything like that. So I thought maybe we could discuss that in light of.
And this is one of the most famous sections of the whole book, book two, section four.
Four, and then he analyzes it through the next several sections.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. The very first paragraph is sort of him just lamenting, in some ways describing the problem. He says, "Yet I chose to steal, and not because want drove me to it, unless want of justice and contempt for it and an excess of inequity. For I stole things which I already had in plenty and of better quality. Nor had I any desire to enjoy the things I stole, but only the stealing of them and the sin." He goes on, "Our only pleasure in doing it was that it was forbidden. Such was my heart, O God, such was my heart, yet in the depth of the abyss you had pity on it. Let that heart know, now tell you what it sought when I was thus evil for no object, having no cause for wrongdoing save my wrongness. I loved my own undoing, I loved the evil in me, not the thing for which I did the evil, simply the evil. My soul was depraved."
And then his analysis, he ends up saying, well, he wouldn't have done this by himself. It really was because he was with other boys. He's 16 years old here. He isolates this in book two because he was between schools. I guess his parents were sometimes, they weren't particularly rich, but they were able to send him away to very career-oriented schools for a lot of the point. But for whatever reason, during this 1 year, he just was left to his own devices running around.
Yep.
And so he's with his friends. And so, yeah, this actually gets at Wes's question of what's wrong with beautiful things. And so the next chapter there, chapter five, book two here, there's an appeal to the eye in beautiful things, in gold and silver and all such. The sense of touch has its own powerful pleasures, and the other senses find qualities in things suited to them. Worldly success has its glory and the power to command and to overcome, and from this springs the thirst for revenge. But in our quest of all these things, we must not depart from you, Lord, or deviate from your law. The life we live below... Here below has its own attractiveness, grounded in the measure of beauty that it has, and its harmony with the beauty of all lesser things. The bond of human friendship is admirable, holding many souls as one. Yet in the enjoyment of all such things, we commit sin, if through immoderate inclination to them. For though they are good, they are the lowest order of good. Things higher and better are forgotten, even you, O Lord our God, and your truth and your law.
And he'll say later, when you enjoy such things, you should turn yourself towards God as the source of them.
Yes.
So again, it's this idea of where the foundation is. It's not that these beautiful things are in and of themselves. It's that they derive their goodness. And you can sort of see the Platonic theme here from something otherworldly. And then that otherworldly entity is the proper object of our attention, as opposed to the worldly things that derive their goodness from, in this case, God.
I was trying to imagine what it would be like to actually love your friends in this way. I was brought to mind the Martin Buber's I and thou thing. I'm sure that's anachronistic,
bring that kind of thing in. Because what he's talking about is, Buber's talking about is a very existential, you know, I'm contemplating you, and through you, I'm contemplating the divine. But that would almost seem idolatrous, I think. The way you described it, Wes, was more, well, I can enjoy you insofar as we are both turned toward God. And so we can sort of be fellows in rejoicing about this higher thing. It's not about, you know, just as having bad friends can make you more likely to sin, as in this case, than having good friends can make you more likely to be godly. But it's not just because of how awesome and humanly they are. In fact, his mother, who he puts as the paragon, seems like just a shell of a human being, frankly. Seems the way he characterizes her is so one-dimensional. And that's good, that a richness of personality would be deviating from your divine pattern.
Yeah. But before we leave the pair analysis, I thought sort of the height of his analysis of this was section 14, 6.14, where he... So perhaps it was the thrill of acting against your law, at least in appearance, since I had no power to do so in fact. The delight a prisoner might have in making some small gesture of liberty, getting a deceptive sense of omnipotence from doing something forbidden without immediate punishment. I was that slave who fled from his lord and pursued his lord's shadow and so on and so forth. What interests me is, again, this, you know, and this is a repeating theme, this idea of... Part of the terribleness of being cut off from God is this delusion of one's own omnipotence, which, of course, if you live like that, you'll be punished for it. But that, to me, is a really perceptive analysis of what the real thrill of stealing the pear is, this sense of power. And I was reminded of sort of the Nietzsche's critique of utilitarianism, where it's not pleasure that's the primary motivator, it's will to power. It's the same thing in this case. It's not pleasure of the pears that's motivating Augustine in this case. It is the power that act involves, that transgression involves.
But what makes his image there of it's like the slave or the prisoner who with this illusion of power, I mean, really, that resonates with us because it's such a petty, you know, it's just boys doing this little thing. And that's sort of how we would think about it now. Like, you know, you think bullying somebody or whatever makes you powerful, but that's just obviously pathetic. That's because you can't exert any real power. But for Augustine, really, it would be thoroughgoing that anyone, even if you're a tyrant over millions of people, then you are, it's an illusion of power somehow. You making all these people bow to your will is in the same way, like the prisoner who is just maybe just from the perspective of your eternity of existence, your time on earth here is only a little tiny blip in the middle of it.
Well, also, but also dictators are vulnerable to being deposed. I mean, that's the basic point. You know, part of his story is about his chasing of fame and worldly goods and all these things. And it's not that he didn't get them. It's not that he wasn't capable of getting them. It's just that they're always subject to the possibility of loss and impermanence and corruptibility and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And so they can't ever be a real foundation for power. So power in that sense is always, the power that they provide is always an illusion. They seem to promise more than they actually give. The act of lust is never actually unfolds all of those implied meanings that it seems to have when we are in the state of fantasizing about it and pursuing it and so on and so forth. It's always disappointing in that sense. It doesn't deliver.
Maybe and maybe not, right? I mean, I don't really buy the direction he's going about how he's overcome by evil and his own evil that he's captured by and in love with. But it might be a correct understanding that he is enjoying or partaking of his own willfulness for willfulness's sake. So that the breaking of the rules is its own thrill and its own pleasure. And that's what he's attracted to. In some ways, that's the basic self-understanding. And that sounds sort of right. And I wouldn't want to dismiss that inclination. And it's not clear to me that it's always bad. I can think of all kinds of examples where it seems kind of petty, but
that it's always bad from his perspective?
No, that's always bad in general, right?
Well, of course, it's just his perspective is so narrow and screwed up, but we're trying to, I thought we were trying to say what Augustine means in his language, so I'm not.
Dylan, are you saying Augustine doesn't necessarily think that willing simply for willing's sake is always bad? Or you're saying it's not always been?
I'm trying on the one hand to recognize his, he seems to be right to understand that it's an act of self-assertion.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something right on about his diagnosis of that act of stealing the pears for the sake of stealing the pears. And putting aside the moral judgment on it and how far he is going with saying that this is like the source of his deep evil.
Yeah.
It does seem a right observation that this is something in not just a 16-year-old's soul, is in people's souls to, I mean, one version of it is you want to win, right? Every Tuesday night, I'm out playing soccer with these over 40 guys. And every other time, there's somebody out there that he gets his spirit up so high that because you took the ball from him and bumped into him, he's going to come and take you out later.
So I see this as an actual differing case because it's not transgressive. And the part that Mark read, he was talking about beautiful things. His whole point of setting that up is that there are lots of reasons that we might be motivated to do things in life. Winning, sex, money, the beauty of things. But the pear thing doesn't fall into any of those categories.
Say why not? Because it seems to me that the stealing of the pears falls neatly into that category of transgressing and asserting your will against the rules, against other people.
I think you're onto something there. What you seem to be saying now is that pleasure of winning is at least in part reducible to this idea of the pleasure of willing for willing's sake, something like that.
Yeah. And in his case, he diagnoses it as the pleasure of being part of a gang and winning. So they together transgressed and stole these pears for the sake of it, asserted their power as a group. And in fact, that seems to be also rightly an added part of the whole pleasure of being part of a gang and asserting your will as a part of a gang on the world, be it stealing.
That's a little complex there, though, because he says he wouldn't have done it without the companionship, but it wasn't because of the companionship that he did it. The companionship was a sort of catalyst. So he asked a question in section 16, perhaps then what I really loved was the companionship of those with whom I did it.
But that sounds just like being part of a group where by yourself you would never have done X, but together you do it, but not simply because you were goaded into it, but because you were part of this group that did it.
But he concludes that section by saying, but since the pleasure I got was not in the pears, it must have been in the crime itself and put there by the companionship of others sinning with me.
Mm-hmm.
So I take him, he's asking the question of whether, well, maybe my primary motivation wasn't simply transgression, but it was just trying to be in with these other kids. I take it to his conclusion is that, well, without the companionship, this wouldn't have happened, but that actually is not the main motivator. The transgression is the main motivator and the companionship is the catalyst that it needed. You know, so for me, stopping it willing for willing's sake isn't enough because then I want to know psychologically, why are people motivated in that way? Eva talked about toddlers and this idea of, and I think we touched on it a little bit, this idea of establishing boundaries and an identity at that stage in life, that willfulness that they exhibit. And that's why I liked his analysis at 14. I saw that as the high point, because then he gets into this quote unquote deceptive sense of omnipotence. I thought that was the plausible psychological root of all that.
It sounds right. That's one of the reasons why I was linking it up with the idea of winning in the sense of asserting your power. And if you make it psychological, you say that it's part of asserting your identity. Those victories become part of who you are.
Yeah, we go back to an Aristotelian notion of actualization. And again, I'm linking with Nietzsche here as well, which I know is odd to relate Augustine to Nietzsche. But this Aristotelian idea is that your being is enhanced. You are more what you are in those moments.
Yes.
Assuming that winning is part of your function and all that.
It becomes kind of fuzzy here because with Augustine, he seems to, on the one hand, articulate exactly what we're describing of the function of will and identity in some respect, but want to at least turn it differently, if not point to it as the source of evil, actually. In fact, it is. It's the source of evil in the world.
Exactly.
So
this is, I think, the real contrast with the eudaimonistic picture, where I think power actually fits into that. Potentiality, as Aristotle would have.
I think we can hook this back to reason, that I was saying if you're using the wrong concepts, if you don't have the right doctrine, then even trying to reason out things honestly, you're not going to come to the right answer. But on the other hand, having the right doctrine ultimately comes down to unifying your will and making it in accord with God's will. So then you
take his law and internalize it, just like he's internalized the Bible so that every other freaking thing that comes out of his mouth is something, a direct quote from Psalms. And so in section 13 here, this is still book 2, chapter 6, he lists all these vices, and they're all a case of misdirectedness. And so misdirectedness, you could see as either a conceptual mistake, or you could see it as an act of will. So the way it starts, it says in brackets, for there is a certain show of beauty in sin. I don't know what the brackets mean. Thus pride wears the mask of loftiness of spirit, though you alone, O God, are high over all. Ambition seeks honor and glory, although you alone are to be honored before all and glorious forever. By cruelty, the great seek to be feared. Yet who is to be feared but God alone? From his power, what can be wrested away? Or when or where or how or by whom? So that, in particular, that last example is just like I was saying that, you know, anything that you do, it's kind of like the prisoner with this illusion of omnipotence or whatever, that all of our willfulness is really childish because the reality is that God's presence overwhelms anything that our puny little will could want to do. And so the most that we can do when we will otherwise, when we put our ambitions into something else, so we instead of rejoicing in God, we rejoice in ourselves. That's pride. When we seek honor and glory instead of just trying to accord with God's will, we're throwing a little childish tantrum, which is equally misguided in terms of we're not seeing things clearly. We're making a conceptual mistake, but also it's willful. And I think those are one and the same.
I think there's an explanation for why he thinks willfulness is evil. And I don't see this as just an intellectual mistake. So for instance, when he says, ambition seeks honor and glory, although you and alone are to be honored before all and glorious forever, that word forever is actually important because suppose if I had secured my glory as a teacher of rhetoric, that were something permanent in the world and the solution to all my problems, and it provided me with peace.
Tenure.
And it could never be taken away. Yeah. Except in Wisconsin. It would be morally just as legitimate as a solution. I think the problem with those solutions for Augustine is their corruptibility, their transience, the fact that you can lose them, they can be taken away. They're actually not the secure footings that I think he's looking for, the secure foundation. And to treat them as such in our fantasies, and I think he's absolutely right about this, we treat them as such. We treat them as if they are sort of final solutions. Oh, if once I have this, then everything's going to be all right. No. It's more problems. More money, more problems.
I still think you can say that's an intellectual mistake.
Okay.
But it's also a moral mistake. And so you end up being blamed for having wrong views about things because, like you said, the divine ends up being the a priori. So if you're sort of rightly aligned with God, then things will be clearer to you. Maybe you didn't read the right books yet. Maybe you need a little more instruction. Even if you read the right books, if you're not oriented toward God, you're not going to get it. You're going to scorn the correct doctrines.
My way of saying this is that you can't be happy for Augustine without God. And this is really about his quest for happiness and how he didn't find it until he found God. And the rest of the stuff, he describes it as miserable, even though it didn't sound all that bad to me. But teaching positions, the women, the this, that. And I wish he had explained that more. You know, other than this sort of abstract, oh, you can lose these things, or it's of this world and it's becoming. I wanted to know what made Augustine so miserable that he was on this quest.
Well, and in fact, one particular question would be, like, he rails against his position in rhetoric in a number of places. And in fact, in the next chapter, talks about how he falls in love with plays and stuff like that. Did you get anything more out of it than him saying that and it seeming that it should be plain and obvious why falling in love with plays was terrible?
Right.
I didn't see him arguing that it was bad, a la Plato and the Republic, that certain kinds of rhetoric or speaking or speechifying was bad and that poetry was bad because it wasn't pointed towards the good. And same thing for rhetoric, that he seems to imply that it was bad that he was a rhetorician because he was not pointed towards the truth and wasn't speaking well towards the right sorts of things.
Yeah.
He doesn't seem like he ever says it that way to me. It just seems to be implied that, yeah, I was a terrible person because I was merely teaching rhetoric and I fell in love with these plays, and that on the face of it was going to be obvious that those were yet signs of his depraved soul.
I think you're right, Dylan. Most of it's implied. It's sort of the Gorgias argument. He's teaching people how to use words to move up in the world, but he's not teaching them what's good or what's true. And then the only thing with the plays I saw, he does have a whole little discourse on pity in section 3 of book 3. He talks about plays, the sense in which we go to them and we take pleasure in other people's sorrows. And he contrasts the pleasure of pity with true compassion, which is not really pleasurable because we simply feel the sorrow for the other person. He seemed to be offering an argument there that plays are producing this kind of vicious pity as opposed to real compassion. So that's the only explanation I saw there, but I had the same reaction as you.
So is he against real pity for people? I thought his big point here was that these are fictitious situations. Let's read some of that diatribe against pity then.
Book 3, chapter 2, section 3.
So that tears and sorrow, it would seem, are things to be sought. That is when people take
pleasure in pitying others.
But he's talking about this in the context of how the spectator of a play wants to go and suffer, wants to feel this pity.
But then he contrasts compassion. So is compassion feeling for others, even though he's talking about plays, I think he thinks pity in general is to be shunned because it's a way of taking pleasure in other people's sorrow. The sorrows of others must move our love. The distinction is that instead of just simply getting pleasure, the sorrow moves our love. Later on in that paragraph, the sorrow I feel for him gives me no pleasure, and so on.
Still, I'm seeing the context to this. Tears and sorrows would seem are things to be sought. Yet surely every man prefers to be joyful. May it be that whereas no one wants to be miserable, there is a real pleasure in pitying others, and we love their sorrows because without them, we should have nothing to pity. All this takes its rise in that stream of friendship of which we have been speaking. But where does that stream go? What is the direction of its flow? Why, it must run into and lose itself in the torrent of pitch which boils out in great waves of vile lust. For by some inclination it's in itself, friendship is twisted and torn away from its heavenly cleanness.
That section I didn't understand. The context here seems to be broader than simply plays now. So he's talking about it arising in friendship and...
And then right after that is the part that you started to read. Is compassion feeling for others therefore to be shunned? By no means. The sorrows of others must move our love. But beware of uncleanness, O my soul, under the protection of my God, the God of our fathers, who is to be praised and exalted above all forever. Beware of uncleanness. I can still feel for others. But in those days when I went to theaters, I was glad with lovers when they sinfully enjoyed each other, although the whole thing was merely fictitious and part of a stage play. And when they lost each other, I was sad for them. But either way, I enjoyed the play. But today I have more pity for the sinner getting enjoyment from his sin than when he suffers torment from the loss of pleasure, which is ultimately destructive, the loss of happiness, which is only misery.
So he's switching back and forth between plays and reality. It's not simply limited to plays.
It's not that pity is bad. I feel like he's using the terms pity and compassion synonymously.
No, he's not. Well, let me read the next sentence. This clearly is the truer compassion, but the sorrow I feel for him gives me no pleasure. It seems to me he's using compassion to mean when I move to love and sorrow from seeing someone's sorrow, and pity is when I move to pleasure from seeing someone else's sorrow. We know what we mean, regardless of whether he's really making that semantic distinction. We know there's a distinction between those two things. And
the question is, when we've had discussions about this in the past, part of it is in the context of Nietzsche or more recently in Emerson.
Yeah, I thought it was just quite similar to Nietzsche. Yeah.
Well, but I think usually the contrast there is between pity and empathy. That if you simply pity someone, you're really not empathizing with them. You're actually kind of looking down on them. But if you really feel for them and are moved to action like you're talking about, then that sounds like compassion. But look at the way Augustine is using it. He immediately says, you're moved, but don't be unclean. So in other words, you should not sympathize with someone who is suffering because of their sin. In other words, sympathize with them is kind of you feel like they feel. So the example he gives is if you are pining for your lost love, well, love itself, romantic love, ends up being to a greater or lesser extent sinful. Certainly these people in these plays or in a lots of, if you're thinking about young people who are not married, he would definitely call all these people sinful. And so to sympathize with them, to feel for them would be pity in the bad sense, even though we might think, oh, that's being compassionate. No, to him being compassionate is to actually be judgmental about them, is to be kind of a dick that you should love the sinner but hate the sin, which is not being sympathetic with them at all. I'm sympathetic with your better you.
It depends on your stance there. You're being sympathetic in the sense that you're worried about the damnation of their soul. You're not worried, oh, he lost his wife, how tragic. It's, oh, how tragic that he's so attached to the things of this world. That's not a great example, but that's in the general.
No, right.
So it's still sort of an empathy or sympathy, depending on how you want to distinguish those. But let's not do that. But it's still directed now differently. But you're right. It's more judgmental.
This is actually something I'm a little surprised, but this is something we can directly apply to how people think today and what we think about that.
Don't get me started on that.
The kind of attitude that he's expressing here of love the sin or hate the sin, but what does that actually mean for how you relate to the actual person? It's that I actually am not going to sympathize with what you're feeling right now, because what you're feeling right now is based on you being a fuck up. And the only way in which you can say I have compassion for you or I feel for you is if you were to get your act together and see things from the correct point of view and see how much of a fuck up you are, then you would sympathize with my feeling.
I think you're putting it too strongly. You're worried about their soul. It's not that you're a total dick now. It's you're worried about their soul as opposed to their worldly concerns. Like I said, that's shifting.
All right. I guess I'm thinking more of it in terms of how if your pet is suffering. So you worry about your pet. You love your pet and you don't want your pet to suffer. But that doesn't mean that you in any way feel for it in the way that if it's suffering because I want more food. That's how, what my dog expresses. Both of my pets express all fucking day long.
Yes.
Said, I'm suffering so much. You have put me through this. So the correct sort of compassion, the Augustinian sort of compassion toward them, is not to sympathize with them in any way. No.
Well, it's, you're reminding me of the story about his mother when she was young that he tells. Do you remember?
Oh,
that?
Tell that. I love that.
So she had basically a caretaker who
a servant
who was really great, and part of why she was so great was she deprived the mother of water during the day so that she wouldn't
develop a thirst. She would control her appetites.
Yes, to control her appetites. It's like, wow, water?
Because if you end up being too thirsty for water, you're going to end up being thirsty for wine.
And then his mother does go through a little drunken period. Do you remember that?
Yes, although it's strange that comes, you know, it's like, oh, she was raised right by this lady.
I know. It made no sense.
But then it didn't work. It didn't take. Because she was, as a child, she was asked to go refill her parents' cup or something. And she would just taste a little of the wine. And then eventually she'd drink more and more.
The opposite explanation is equally plausible, which is that she was deprived of water and developed an oral fixation and then became a drunk.
This is why you should never talk to children about sex. Because if you talk to them about sex, then they're going to go have sex. But obviously, if you don't talk to them about sex and don't expose them, then they'll never have sex.
Yes, it always works. Also, make sure they've never heard of the internet at this point.
Okay, that's all you get for part one of the episode. Come back for part two next week. Or if you're a PEL citizen, you can get the whole thing right now. Go to partiallyexaminedlife.com. Sign up. You get full ad-free versions. And for this little postscript, I have Seth back here, who you might have noticed just disappeared somewhere during the episode. He was with us, and then he was gone. I think he was stricken down. What was going on there, Seth?
Well, it was certainly not by choice, so I apologize to the listeners. I had prepared for the episode, and I was particularly interested in the conversion story that really had a strong effect on me. And I had gone to dinner with my wife and we had been discussing it. And I was very excited to talk about this notion of the conversion experience. And during the early part of the conversation, when the guys were getting off on some of the finer points of metaphysics and various other things that Augustine was talking about, I started to develop kind of a headache and got a little disoriented. I think I had some kind of a little food allergy reaction and ended up having to bow out because I just couldn't stay focused on the conversation and felt a little under the weather. So it was a disappointment, but I did want to comment about what was interesting about the arc of the narrative around the fact that Augustine distinguishes between two phases of his conversion. The first is saying that he didn't know what the right thing to do was. So in a sense, he kind of excused himself and said, well, when I was younger and I didn't know what was the right thing to do, it was okay that I wasn't doing the right thing. But he makes an explicit change in his, once he knows that the Catholic Church is the true church, but he still doesn't convert. You know, and this is when I was reading this is when I tweeted out that thing about God grant me chastity, but not yet, something like that. And so for me, what it did was two things. One, it's a really interesting personal narrative about the notion of self-improvement. In this case, it's a religious conversion, but it's anybody who struggles with knowing what they should be doing and feeling like they can't for whatever reason. And then the other part of it is that it made me very much understand what we had been talking about with respect to Eva's book and why she put such a focus on Augustine, understanding truly what it's meant by if knowledge is virtue, when you know something, then you do it. And Augustine very clearly is saying, no, I knew quite well what I was supposed to be doing and I wasn't doing it. That in his case, he was talking about not being able to overcome his lustful desires. So it really brought it home for me. And I felt like it was a very personal story. It was something that I think very relatable. It's not often that we read older works of philosophy and you have to work sometimes to get the relatability. And in this one, I think talking about struggling to overcome your better instincts, right? Or doing things that you know are wrong. I think it's personal and relatable, but it's also sort of the very first pointing towards kind of a psychological aspect to behavior in a philosophical context that it was really interesting. So I'm sorry I did not participate in the conversation, but I wanted people to know that I heartily endorse this selection. And I really think as easy as it is to read and as important a work as it is, everybody should get out there and take a look at it. I've checked mine out from my local library, and I encourage you to make use of those resources in your area as well.
You sound like this episode was sponsored by St. Augustine.
Episode was sponsored by...
Told me at the time that it was a combination of the conversation that we were having and that it wasn't going in the direction that you expected, but also just Augustine himself was just not relatable, and basically that was making you sick, that immersing yourself in that in the previous couple of days just made you so nauseous that you couldn't get through the conversation. Whether or not that's true, I think it's a better story than what you just told.
Well, in that case, please disregard everything I said and believe what Mark is saying.
All right, thanks.
All right, thank you.
So here's a new feature we're going to try. Here's Nathan, our new Not School Administrator, to tell you what's going on in Not School News.
My name's Nathan Hanks, and I host a fiction group in the Partially Examined Life's Not School. There are several groups going on right now. Maybe you're interested in reading an essay by Judith Butler or a chapter from John Searle's book. Maybe a short story by Isaac Asimov or a novel by Albert Camus. You may want to listen to past conversations. Maybe there's a conversation you can't find and want to start yourself. You can do that by proposing your own in the forum. If you are not a member and have thought about becoming one, I'd highly recommend it. It's been a lot of fun. Happy reading.